change really is, it's a big disruptor. And I think that even though the bulk of what's happening is very negative, there are opportunities. This is an opportunity for us to have a big shift in our mindset. Similar to COVID, think about the collective good. And for people to really understand that we are interconnected.
This is Meaningful Medicine. In a challenging and unpredictable world with high burnout rates, this is a podcast where incredible individuals share their most meaningful patient experiences and focus on those moments of positivity and joy that sparked their love of healthcare and changed the way they practice medicine.
Hi, I'm Nicole Hohenstein, and I'm an emergency medicine resident at UCSF.
Hi, I'm Shiva Kayambashi. I'm a doctor and professor of family and community medicine at UCSF.
We're the co-hosts of Meaningful Medicine. We created this podcast to highlight stories of healthcare professionals who have found a sense of meaning, resilience, and joy in their work. Hey, Shiva, how are you doing?
Hi, Nicole. I'm doing pretty good today. Thank you. How are you today?
I am doing excellent. I'm so excited that we are going to be tackling the topic of climate change in medicine. This is a topic that I am not as familiar with, but I think climate change affects all of us. And I'm so excited to be talking about the unique perspective of climate change, specifically in the view of the healthcare system.
I am too, Nicole. I'm really excited about our special guest today and about this topic. So it's about life, really. It's about the broader scope of what life is about. And I think one thing I had been thinking about is how many more disasters we've been seeing, natural disasters in our lifetime, between floods and hurricanes and just extremes of weather, that the drastic things that have been happening. We're watching water levels rise and the glaciers are melting. And I've just been thinking about that and how humanity is being affected in catastrophic ways, in huge catastrophes, and life, not just human life, animal life and bird life and all life is being affected and being lost, and suffering is being created. And those are the catastrophic things. And then there's the long-term things that are just like, gradually we're losing our ozone layer, gradually we're having dirtier air, more pollution in our air and in our water. And these are the more chronic things. And it kind of feels sort of reminiscent of what it is in healthcare, where we have acute crises that we deal with and we have chronic conditions that we deal with. I think climate change is a factor in all of it. It may not be causal for everything, but it's a factor in all of our acute and chronic health conditions too. So what do you think, Nicole?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it definitely impacts our lives, our patients' lives. And as we're thinking about what's happening right now, there is a large group of medical students gearing up to submit their ERAS and start interviewing for residencies. And because of the pandemic, there has been this transition from in-person interviews to virtual interviews. And one of my awesome friends, Carly Hampshire, and some of her colleagues came up with this really cool initiative that I just wanted to do a plug for. It's called the Interview Without Harm Initiative. And this is an awesome initiative. We'll link it in the show notes. This is an initiative where you can plug in all of the cities in which you will interview in, and then it calculates the total emissions that you would be using and the total savings of your carbon footprint that would have happened if the interviews were in person. So I actually calculated mine. So with my 14 interviews that I did last year, I avoided 16,935 miles of flights. I saved 4.06 metric tons of CO2, which is equivalent to almost 30% of the average American's annual carbon footprint.
Wow, that's amazing. That's almost 30% of an annual carbon footprint of that's a year's carbon footprint, and you saved about a quarter to 30%. That's amazing.
It's wild. And this awesome initiative is from the Interview Without Harm Coalition, represents a group of passionate medical students, residents, and faculty who envision a more sustainable, equitable, and efficient process of interviewing medical trainees. So just want to throw in a plug that having this virtual interview process is not only great for applicants, makes it more equitable, but also saves the environment.
I love this initiative because it's continuing. And I hope that a lot of the things that we've learned about trying to do more things virtually and still connect like we are over podcasts, over Zoom, over other virtual methods, I think that we can actually do a lot of good change.
I agree. I think working towards a sustainable future is now kind of a new goal. And I'm so excited to bring on an expert because Shiva and I are definitely not experts on this field and excited to learn. Today, we are excited to announce Dr. Heather Whelan to discuss her experience as a climate change activist and educator in medicine. Dr. Whelan completed her medical school training at UC Davis and her internal medicine residency at UCLA Olive Yule. She then completed a master's degree in medical education at NYU and is heavily involved in medical student education and career advising at UCSF. Dr. Whelan is passionate about advancing the medical school curriculum on climate change and health and has developed numerous educational lectures and modules about this topic. Welcome, Dr. Whelan.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're so happy to have you here with us, Dr. Whelan. Really grateful for your taking the time and helping us learn what we need to know as people and as clinicians and physicians and students in training. So again, we really thank you for making the time out of your schedule to be with us today. We like to start every episode by asking our guests if you could, in short, could you share a meaningful moment from sometime early on in your training that was especially formative or a defining type of an experience for you?
Yeah, I would love to do that. The experience I'm going to share actually occurred a little bit later in my career when I was early on in my hospital medicine career. I work at the VA now, but I was a hospitalist at Parnassus for a couple of years. And I remember I was on a shift and carrying the pager, and I got a call one day for an admission for a woman who had ALS and was being admitted basically to die. And I had never encountered this situation before. It was definitely like a new challenge to navigate. And, you know, obviously palliative care was going to be involved and sort of shepherding us along, but it definitely was kind of anxiety provoking for me just because it felt fraught just in terms of, I think, the explicitness of her deciding to die, as well as, you know, wanting to ensure that she was not suffering in any way along the way. So I went to meet her and I ended up, you know, sitting down and spending quite a bit of time with her to really understand, was this truly her decision? And was the decision-making process behind it a sound one? And I think in some ways a very transformative conversation for me because, you know, she just shared all about her life and her family and the people who were important to her and all the things that she had done that were, you know, on her bucket list and things that were still on the list, but she understood that she could not do anymore. And she was at this point surviving by using BiPAP quite many hours during the day, particularly at night. So we had this long conversation and, you know, I came to the conclusion that this was what she wanted. She was very clear about it. She was very clear about, you know, what had meaning in her life and that her quality of life was no longer what she wanted it to be. And it was time for her to move on. So palliative care was involved. We sort of managed her passing with some benzodiazepines and opiates. And so in the span of, you know, maybe like 36 hours to 48 hours, she had all this family and friends coming to visit. And, you know, like, I think it was a very sad situation and also kind of like a weird celebration of life. It was nice to see so many people supporting her and she did pass peacefully. I think it struck me about how much in medicine, what we really are trying to do is preserve quality of life and length of life, but really that quality of life is so very important. And I was just impressed by her courage, you know, to make this very conscious decision to leave this life experience and how she really, I don't know, sort of navigated it so gracefully. You know, there's a way in which even in the most difficult circumstances, you can accept what is reality and then you move forward in the best way you can. And so you always have some agency.
Thank you so much for sharing that story of self-advocacy and the importance of autonomy, especially when we're discussing important things like end-of-life care. And she chose to withdraw care and you were in her family were able to support her in that choice. you know, thinking about the health of the planet and thinking about the many advocates there are for climate change, I think this is the perfect transition as we discuss the unique role that physicians can play in combating climate change. Dr. Whelan, what sparked your interest in this field?
Yeah, so I mean, I think I have always been somebody who gained a lot from being in nature. You know, it is a happy place for me to be outside and in contact with nature. It's also like the go-to place when I'm not feeling happy, you know, so I think it's sort of like a place of solace and joy for me. And so that's kind of the backdrop. And I think growing up, I was always very environmentally aware. I grew up in Southern California. And, you know, we used to have these like bad air quality days where there would be different gradations of how bad the air was and whether or not you should be outside or not. And definitely like can remember a few days where, you know, you try to breathe and your chest is tight. And I remember being already very attuned to those things. And I remember also when I started learning to drive, I would feel anxious about sitting and letting the car idle. Just, I would be like, you can't do that because this is going to have an impact. So, you know, this orientation towards the environment and our impact is longstanding. And then more recently, you know, I had seen like everybody things in the news and heard about it. And I think when I actually engaged and really started reading the stories and like looking at the data, it was like very dramatic and a little overwhelming in terms of how stark things were. And I think I kind of went through my own iterations of avoidance and then ended up working with and developing friendships with a couple of colleagues who were already doing work in this area. And so became more informed about, you know, well, how, what can I do? How can I take action? And I think that was very appealing to me because I was going to have anxiety about it anyway. And I could either walk around trying to avoid it, which isn't a very effective strategy, or I could more fully engage and try to make a difference. And, you know, it's been really nice to also see what kind of community there is in the folks who are working on this.
I love that. And I love how much nature matters to you and how much solace when you're having a hard time, joy when you're looking for something to be elated about, which is found for me too, and I think so many of us, in the sky and the trees and the birds and the forest and the rivers and the ocean. And just what a blessing and gift it is that we have access to the clean. I think here living in California, we actually have a lot of wonderful resources that we can get out to and enjoy nature, but it's not every day and it's not everywhere, not even in California. A couple of years ago, we had the horrible wildfires here, remember? And we just, there was a day, do you remember, that the sky, the sun didn't seem to come up. The sky was dark the whole day. And I know that that's going on right now. We are having wildfires in the Pacific Northwest. And it's just a matter of time. I think we're all sort of walking on eggshells waiting for when is that going to happen here to us? Or and not only wildfires here, the drought and the dry conditions, but you know, people in all parts of our country and the world obviously are dealing with these fears of the next catastrophe that's going to happen where nature isn't going to be available. So we're talking just really about how climate change affects us all, regardless of where you are, how old you are, it's regardless of gender or anything else about us. We're all human and we all live on the planet, and it can affect every part of our bodies, our organ systems. So ozone depletion and air pollution can lead to both increased skin cancer and more rates of asthma exacerbations and lung disease. We find that extremes of heat due to climate change has also been risked to increase risks of ED, emergency department visits for mental health conditions. And there are studies that show that exposure to particulate matter in the air can even increase the risk of delivering an infant at a lower birth weight. These are some example studies that were taken from Climate Resources for Health Education, which is a repository of evidence-based learning materials on climate change and health. And Dr. Whelan is a part of this organization, Climate Resources for Health Education. Dr. Whelan, why do you think that healthcare workers in particular should care about climate change? And how do you feel healthcare workers can, in any unique way, leverage their role in patient care to advocate for climate change that maybe other professionals can't really do in their line of work?
I think there are a lot of reasons. You know, I think one reason is that we have the privilege that, A, we know more about health and what factors affect health for good and for bad. And we also are in a position of privilege and that we are more trusted than many other people by the public, by policymakers, by patients. And so when we speak, people actually do listen. And so I think we kind of have the opportunity to make a difference in that regard. I think also that, you know, climate change is what they call a threat multiplier. So for patients who have existing vulnerabilities, whether those are things like their comorbidities, that they have heart failure or asthma, or they're very old or very young or pregnant and physiologically more vulnerable, or there are social determinants of health that put them at more risk. So for example, patients who live in urban areas that have a lot of built environment, asphalt, concrete, and very little green space. These are what we call urban heat islands. And so the average temperature is generally much higher in these places, in addition to having more air pollution. And so, you know, the people who live in these neighborhoods generally are not there by choice. It's because they can't afford to live elsewhere. The quality of the housing that they live in is oftentimes subpar as well. So poor insulation, no air conditioning, they're reliant on public transportation, so they can't drive in their air-conditioned car somewhere. You know, all these factors that I think we are becoming more aware of, and we can advocate for policy changes and partnerships with community organizations to really address these things. So again, I think we sort of have knowledge and agency that other people don't. I would say there's also, you know, healthcare is responsible for at least 10% of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. It's a lot. And so we also kind of, you know, when you think about this maxim of first do no harm, then we are responsible to not do harm and to try to make our healthcare systems greener. And there's, as we know, there's a ton of waste in healthcare. High value care and quality improvement projects have already highlighted that, but there's waste in terms of the energy we use. We can sort of try to buy green energy, so solar power, wind powered energy, or lobby for that, use again our buying power as large organizations. Similarly, with pharmaceuticals and medical devices that are manufactured and have a carbon footprint, we can decide which products are being made with less of an environmental impact, and then we can use our buying power to buy what is being made more sustainably. You know, things like telehealth. Like this Zoom call, this is a less carbon intensive way to communicate or to provide care. So there are all these different ways that we can engage in our own healthcare system to do less damage. So what we call sustainable care. And then we can also work to help adaptation. So the other problem for healthcare systems is that in a climate disaster, like an extreme heat event or a flood or a hurricane, sometimes the healthcare building is not going to be able to function. The East Coast with Hurricane Sandy, they got flooded. The generators stopped working. They had to transfer all these patients out. We've seen in Northern California where Kaiser had to transfer patients from Santa Rosa. So thinking about how to make the healthcare plant itself and then the systems, so like EMS and all the communication that needs to happen and coordination of care to make that a better system. So in any case, like obviously there are many, many ways that healthcare providers I think can be involved to make things better. And I sort of feel like there's a moral imperative to do something.
Thank you so much. I had no idea that 10% of carbon emissions are from healthcare. That is wild. And I love kind of when you think about when you're with your patients, the social determinants of health, you're thinking about multiple things, thinking also about what is the climate that they're living in? What is that environment and how is that affecting their health? And just adding that to your checklist, I think is something that we can do in terms of patient care. We discussed how you created a climate change educational curriculum. I'd love if you could describe how you created this curriculum and some of the key aspects of the program.
Yeah, so I would say I am not the most responsible party in this effort. So just want to first put that out there is that it's a team effort and many other people on the team, I would say, did the bulk of the work, including medical students really did a lot of it. I partnered with a junior faculty member who's over the general hospitalist, Nick Iverson. We got an innovations grant in 2019 from the Academy of Medical Educators to develop a curriculum. And it's been an interesting process because I think it's been an uphill battle in terms of getting institutional buy-in and space in the curriculum. There were many other things going on at the same time in terms of competing priorities. And so we were successful in with the F1 curriculum, which is the preclinical curriculum. There are existing lectures on various different topics, and the students were proactive and basically reached out to course directors and lecturers and said, hey, you know, your lecture on COPD or asthma is ripe for some content about climate change and health and how that impacts things. Would you be open to us collaborating? We can tell you where we think we could insert content. We will make the slides and send them to you for review and tell you where we think they should go in your existing lecture. And so that's what happened. So Alan Nadovu, Taryn Sirius were two students who were very involved, Carly Hampshire also. And so we were successful in integrating some of this. It's a small amount of content, but it's a start. Alan developed some slides for the COPD and asthma lecture that show neighborhoods that have been redlined, such as Richmond. And you can see like the urban heat island effect. You can see the air quality effect. And so just very, I think, dramatic and impactful slides. Additionally, one of our other students, Rio Barrera-Kane, has been doing some work with the inquiry curriculum, which is really more about investigation and learning how to research and expand your own knowledge. And so she has been successful in working to get some small groups, case-based learning focused on that. We have an upcoming session that will be on air quality. And then she also was successful in inviting some community members who are environmental advocates to come and speak with the class. So it's a small footprint and we're continuing to try to expand. But I would say that the effort would not have been successful without their efforts. We were also successful in developing a curriculum map that included learning objectives, different topic areas, suggested teaching points, and then some resources. And that body of work, which took us a while, was what led us to collaborate on the Climate Resources and Health Education project, because they used our objectives along with some other groups' objectives to form the foundation of what topics we should be addressing in the materials that they're ultimately developing.
That's awesome. That's really so amazing. I don't think climate change education is available. Certainly, this is so innovative and it's necessary, right? It's time. It's way beyond time that it should be talked about. I think not just in medical school, obviously, but you know, in every level of education, right? In every field. And I think the more we talk about it and integrate it the way you've done so beautifully, right? Bringing it into every lecture on almost every topic, you could bring the environment and climate change into it. Even if it's a small footprint and just even a comment, I feel like it just brings to your mindset as a student or as a learner that, oh, that's important. How do you mobilize? How do you inspire? How do you encourage? How do you bring hope and motivation in light of the fact that a lot of people feel really pessimistic? Other than educating, how do you inspire and motivate?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I think that's an important question that all of us have to navigate. You know, I mean, I think that the reality of climate change is scary and overwhelming. And I think that all of us have to navigate that in some way. And I do think there's an initial stage at which people sort of realize, wow, this is really bad. And some people, it's almost like the fight, flight, freeze, right? You know, some people freeze up and they're just going to avoid it for a while. Other people, maybe flight is more like avoidance, but sometimes people go straight to inaction or rumination. And then some people go to action. And I guess what I would say is that for me, action has actually been the therapy. This is the way in which I control my anxiety, because aside from what the outcome is, I think there is value in the process of working for positive change. And then I think also the community that is built in working together with people who have similar values and passions. I also think that, you know, climate change really is, it's a big disruptor. And I think that even though the bulk of what's happening is very negative, there are opportunities. This is an opportunity for us to have a big shift in our mindset. Similar to COVID, think about the collective good. And for people to really understand that we are interconnected, whether you like it or not, climate change is telling you that we are all interconnected. And I think that the people who are less engaged in this issue, sometimes it's just because it hasn't touched them in a really dramatic way yet, but it will. And so, you know, the hope is that people understand and get mobilized before that. And I certainly do think that building this awareness of collective good and empathy and interconnectedness is so important in that work. If it's okay, I have this quote from Rebecca Solnit. She's an author and an activist, and she actually lives here in San Francisco. And she wrote this book on hope. Hope locates itself in the premises that we don't know what will happen, and that in the spaciousness of uncertainty is room to act. When you recognize uncertainty, you recognize that you may be able to influence the outcomes. You alone, or you in concert with a few dozen or several million others. Hope is an embrace of the unknown and the unknowable, an alternative to the certainty of both optimists and pessimists. Optimists think it will all be fine without our involvement. Pessimists take the opposite position. Both excuse themselves from acting. It's the belief what we do matters, even though how and when it may matter, who and what it may impact, are not things we can know beforehand. We may not, in fact, know them afterward either, but they matter all the same. And history is full of people whose influence was most powerful after they were gone.
I mean, the thing that stuck with me is this space of uncertainty is room to act. I mean, how amazing is that? What an amazing opportunity. And thank you so much for your work on this important topic. And there is a lot of room where we can definitely jump in and do our part. And Dr. Whelan, so because you created this awesome curriculum, can you share some of the hopes that you have after implementing this curriculum, as well as in an ideal world? We love to think about these ideal worlds. How would patient care and hospital systems look like in a more climate conscious environment?
I think in terms of what I hope for the curriculum, you know, I think at this point, I just really am hoping to start raising more awareness amongst everyone, students and other trainees, faculty and educators. It's been very interesting. We did some qualitative interviews with some of the F1 faculty that we worked with, and it was fascinating to me how they were like, yeah, I learned so much about this. I had no idea climate change was such a big deal. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting because, you know, you are deep in this organ system. And just, I think also the appreciation for how complex the relationships are and how important it is to address systems and structures in addressing this crisis altogether. And so I think I'm hoping that, again, learners gain an appreciation for that and gain an appreciation that health equity is at the center of all of this and is important for us to include in our approach, and then to include these populations and communities in coming up with solutions as well. I think in terms of your question about like what would the ideal healthcare system look like, I mean, I think that we're a long way from that right now, but I think that it would be, you know, really more cognizance of where there's environmental waste and where we are contributing to the problem and then finding solutions to that. There's a framework that came out of the UK that's called SUSCE. It's a combination of sustainability and QI that is really a framework around healthcare sustainability. So how do you make healthcare systems more sustainable? But also it's more holistic. So it includes, how do you have leadership and governance who values this and plans for this? How do you create communities that are resilient? And what are the co-benefits of these changes? So if you have a plant-based diet, that helps the planet, it helps your own health. If you walk to work or ride a bike instead of driving in your car, again, there are what we call co-benefits. So, you know, basically a system and an approach that would include more of this holistic approach and sort of the interrelatedness. And then I think just helping to build communities that are psychologically resilient and supported, so that when challenges come their way, they are more ready to respond and then recover. And I think that as a healthcare system, we have a role to play in helping to build that. And then I think also just building a healthcare system that provides for some resilience for us, for healthcare workers and staff who are navigating all of this every day, similar to COVID. But, you know, there are some places where every year there's a terrible hurricane or a flood and they're constantly navigating crisis.
Envisioning that world as you were describing it, that could happen. It feels onerous to think of making such grand changes. And I think that's what sets a lot of people back in terms of getting pessimistic or inactive. Is it's kind of like looking at a mountain saying, well, I'll never climb to the top. That's too high of a mountain. That's too big a task. And so a lot of people feel like I can't because it's too big. But when you just take one step, right? If you can take one step, then you can take the next step, and then you can take the next step, and then gradually you'll find that you've actually gotten to that place where you wanted to be, that goal space. So I appreciated your painting a picture, because I feel like we just need to keep taking steps together and finding each other, you know, finding that community from starting with what you're creating with the curriculum and the group that have come together and coalesced to make this happen. To sort of, I hope people that are listening might think, oh, wow, I'm going to look up Dr. Heather Whelan and see what she's doing and join forces. And maybe there will be more sort of coalescing of the minds and the spirits that really want to do this work together.
Yeah. And I think one other comment that I would just quickly add is that I think it's very easy for many of us as physicians, and I think in this culture, to feel like individually we are responsible and must do something to change things. And we all should take action. But I think having an understanding that this is not something that I'm going to solve by myself, like, and it is the collective action that is needed. And I think maintaining sort of an awareness that we are part of something larger and we're trying to grow something larger, that, like you're saying, there's a snowball effect, right? Where that impact grows exponentially.
For those of us who are interested, if anyone who's listening and they are interested in studying climate change and learning more, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you know of research opportunities, educational and research opportunities for people that are interested to bridge climate change and health.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of like domains, there are many for research. There's more basic science research that's organ specific, you know, pulmonary and looking at interaction between air quality and some of the pathophysiology there, mental health effects, you know, even mental health effects of poor air quality or extreme heat. We know that people don't sleep very well in extreme heat, and that has impacts as well. For like neurologic systems, we know that exposure to long-term like algae toxic blooms can cause neurodegenerative disease, but we don't really know a ton about that. And so there's a lot of exploration there. I think there's a boatload of research to be done in public health and how do we communicate with the public and patients to, similar to COVID, to make them understand that this is a real health threat and to help them take actions that will protect themselves and other people. I think systems research, looking like the emergency medical system and how do we structure that for maximum effect? How do we get creative in use of resources? There was a paper in the New England Journal recently about extreme heat and systems and how do we adapt to that? And they were talking about how, you know, some emergency room waiting rooms, they would just let people stay there as a cooling center. Like they weren't there to get treated. They were just there to hang out until they could leave when it was safe. And just like libraries and all these places that you can repurpose. Healthcare sustainability is like a whole new area in which we're learning how do we be more green with everything. And there's something called these life cycle assessments that look at the life cycle of a product from like extraction of a metal from the earth to production to transportation to use and disposal and like what is the environmental impact of that. And you know, you can use this information then in terms of your purchasing practice. I think we're still learning what are the necessary leadership skills for folks who are going to be leading the space, some of our students right now, and how do we train them for those roles? I think use of narrative medicine and podcasts and storytelling like you all are doing is really helpful because I think that the emotional impact is so important and foundational. I think in terms of like specific opportunities for research, federal government now has Offices of Climate Change and Health Equity that's doing work. AHRQ is doing work. Here at UCSF, we have the Center for Climate Change and Health Equity, who is partnering with all sorts of people at UCSF, but also across the UC system and really sponsoring a lot of opportunities there. NIH, National Academy of Medicine, these folks are all in this space.
It really gets me thinking about the emergency department where I work, and oh my gosh, it's ripe for so many opportunities to decrease our waste. I mean, unlike an OR, a lot of the metal instruments that we use for laceration repairs, putting in chest tubes, they're single use. We throw them away. And it blew my mind when I started working. I was like, there must be a better way. But the fact that that is the situation is mind-boggling, and I think there is definitely room for improvement. And as we wrap up the podcast today, it's been such a pleasure. We love to ask our guests, what advice do you have for medical students and trainees who are early on in their careers?
Yeah, I mean, I think one piece of advice I always give, particularly in my career advising role, is think about what field seems interesting to you and explore that and go for it. But like, think about the rest of your life. You know, this is not necessarily the most important thing in your life. It's important, obviously, but what's going to make you happy in your life in the long term? And medical school is so focused that people forget about that. And I think giving them permission. And then I think also just reminding them that they're so smart and creative and dedicated to even gotten to this point, because I think it's rough. You're surrounded by these really smart, accomplished people. And I think there's a tendency to compare themselves and feel like they're not good enough. And just again, to remind them, figure out what their passion is and follow that. And they don't have to be the best at everything. And then I think when it comes to climate change and health, I think just to start learning about it or join a group like MS4SF, or there's a student elective here at UCSF. We welcome students who want to work on the curriculum with us. Yeah, there are lots of opportunities.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast today. I've learned so much and really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Dr. Whelan. We have all learned so much. It's going to be time to go back and really take some notes on actions that can be taken, groups that can be joined, and more learning to do. So thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me and giving me an opportunity to talk about this topic and hopefully get more people excited and engaged and taking some action. I really appreciate you for doing the podcast.
Thank you for tuning in today
and allowing us to be one of your meaningful moments.
Please rate, review, and subscribe, and share with friends, family, and colleagues. Meaningful Medicine was produced by Shiva Kayambashi, Nicole Hohenstein, David Elkin, Nikki Elkin, Ahaley Chattopadhyay, and Lei Kodama. Editing by Nicole Hohenstein, Nikki Elkin, and Lei Kodama. Intro and closing by Daniel Wendling. On Meaningful Medicine, we are careful to ensure that all stories are compliant with healthcare privacy laws, and details may have been changed to ensure patient confidentiality. All views expressed are of the person speaking and not their employer.